This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
I think that Look Me in the Eye is turning out to be kind of a universal story. I didn't know this when I wrote the book, but I now see that everyone feels that they were a misfit at one time or another, and the fact that I have Asperger's simply concentrated my difficulties.
That's John Elder Robison. We'll be talking with him this hour on Writer's Voice about his book, Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's. We also talk with Free Press's Josh Silver about the latest developments to save the internet from the control of the big telecom companies. That's all coming up. Stay tuned. Do you remember the kid in school who seemed really smart but never fit in? Maybe he had offbeat intellectual obsessions like trains or the weather, and he could recite train schedules back for 100 years or tell you what the weather was on any particular day in history. But when it came to simple social skills, like the natural give and take of conversation, he was lost, and often lonely. That's what it was like for my guest, John Elder Robison. He only found out what made him different from other people when he learned at age 40 that he had Asperger's syndrome. Often called high-functioning autism, Asperger's is characterized by an inability to understand and interpret social cues. Robison grew up in the same dysfunctional family his younger brother, best-selling author Augustine Burroughs, wrote about in his memoir, Running with Scissors. But John Elder Robison says that having Asperger's had nothing to do with his chaotic and sometimes violent family environment. He was born with it, and he says Asperger's isn't even a disorder or illness, but a way of being on the wide human spectrum, with both gifts and disabilities. He's written a sweet and compelling memoir about living with Asperger's called Look Me in the Eye, and we spend most of today's show talking with him about it. Well, John Elder Robison, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks for having me on the show today.
Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's, is the title of your book. When you were 40, you found out that you had Asperger's syndrome, which is kind of a way that brains can work that can make people with Asperger's quite misunderstood by so-called normal people. Your title, Look Me in the Eye, reflects this misunderstanding. How is that?
Well, all through my earlier life, people would say stuff like that to me. They would say, look me in the eye and look at me when I talk to you. And when they did so, it was a simple, obvious command. And I always thought that I complied with their request. But people continue to make the request. So at one level, I knew that I was not doing what people were asking because they kept asking. But then I couldn't imagine what there was to it that I wasn't doing because they would say, look me in the eye, and I would look at the people. And it wasn't until I learned about Asperger's and I actually read descriptions of what is meant by that that I truly understood what I'd been missing all those years.
And what is the difficulty? I mean, you thought you were looking in people's eyes, but you must not have been making the kind of eye contact that people expect, at least in this culture. So what was the difficulty in doing that?
It's not difficult to do it, but you have to know what to do. Like, for example, there's one kind of looking at the eye when you glance at somebody as you're handing him a receipt in a payment line. And there's another kind of looking someone in the eye when you're talking to a potential boss in a job interview. And there's still another kind of look me in the eye when you're looking at a girl and you're out on a date. You know, there's all different kinds of look me in the eye, and they all have different intensities and different durations and different associations and contexts. And I didn't understand that at all until I began learning about Asperger's and what was different about my brain. It never occurred to me before getting that knowledge, that I might just have fundamentally different thought processes in regard to behaviors like that.
Could you say a little bit about What most strikes you about being different in your thought process?
It's very hard to know what strikes me as being different because I'm sort of the way I am, and the way I am is the only thing I know. So my only knowledge of being different is when I read it in a book by a psychologist like the Atwood book, or when I come up against it through some kind of conversational or interactive trouble, like what I'd hear when I was a kid. It's real hard to know then what's different.
The Atwood book?
That's how I learned about Asperger's. A friend who was a therapist, he's quite an insightful fellow, and he lives here in town, actually. His name's T.R. Rosenberg. He came to work one day, and he said when we were out at lunch that therapists learn not to diagnose their friends or they won't have any friends. But he said, I've got this book that describes you to a T, and it was this little blue book by Dr. Tony Atwood called Asperger's Syndrome, and indeed he was right. It did describe me to a T.
You know, it's interesting because some of the things that you describe are things that I can see in other people, even myself as I was growing up, yet I'm pretty sure I don't have Asperger's Syndrome. Difficulty in picking up social cues is something that really can be shared by a number of different, you know, people's brains work in different ways. And I was very interested in what I felt was maybe something that's common to a lot of these, that maybe people with Asperger's have difficulty with social cues, but on the other hand tend to be very creative, or people who are really, really interested in learning about things. And this, I think, is something that is shared with maybe other social misfits as well.
That's certainly true. I think that Look Me in the Eye is turning out to be kind of a universal story. I didn't know this when I wrote the book, but I now see that everyone feels that they were a misfit at one time or another, and the fact that I have Asperger's simply concentrated my difficulties, and perhaps I had a harder time than you did as a non-Aspergian, but everyone seems to see themselves in some component of my story. You said, I don't have Asperger's, and indeed, you may not have Asperger's as such, but all of this is really a continuum where you have extremely normal at one end of the scale and extremely unusual or eccentric or whatever at the other end. And I happen to be at this point in the middle, and maybe you're a little to one side, maybe somebody else a little bit to some other side. So all of us can have some elements of these things in each in us.
Well, let's continue a little bit on the social misfit side of this, because as you say, it really can relate to a lot of people, whether they have been diagnosed with Asperger's or not. Your difficulty in picking up social cues, describe this a bit. I really love the story that you told about going to preschool and wanting to make friends with a little girl named Chucky. Could you tell us that story?
Well, what happened there was I was about 5 years old, and I found myself in this preschool, and I wanted to make friends with this girl who was playing with a truck in the sandbox with me. So I went over to her, and I tried to pet her, just like I petted my poodle. But it didn't work. She smacked me and ran off. And I didn't really understand that people would not respond the same way as poodles. And in fact, I still don't understand that, because I respond to petting, and I think sometimes it's kind of hypocritical that other people do. Some do and some don't. So that's an example of maybe seeing things differently.
Is it because people are perhaps responding more according to what they understand as a social convention, and you are responding just more directly out of your own feelings, unmediated by social conventions?
I think that may be the case. I think that autistic people are described as having certain components of their brains that are closer to animal in nature, so that I may respond more like a a chimpanzee or a gorilla might, and it's kind of like a grooming behavior, where humans have evolved these social conventions, which I would contend are often false and hypocritical, and we sort of hide them behind the guise of manners and etiquette. I think a lot of the time humans could learn a lot about behavior from observing monkeys and gorillas.
Yeah, in fact, you say right up in the early part of the book, you say this whole idea of, you know, look me in the eye, that people thought of you as being, you know, kind of shifty and unreliable because you didn't. And yet you say plenty of shifty, unreliable people have been able to look you right straight in the eye.
That's exactly right. Anyone who has operated a business knows that people will come in and look you in the eye and then lie to you. So the idea that looking people in the eye is a sign of truthfulness simply isn't so. It may be a rule of thumb, but it is by no means always correct.
Yeah, in fact, I know with people who have ADD, they often can't look people in the eye because if they do, they can't process what they're saying.
That's what happens to me. I describe that in my book. I describe how instead of looking at your face, where I might become distracted by a curl of hair or a button on your shirt or a chunk of fuzz on your sweater and stop talking, I look at a neutral area, like I look at the gray desktop or I look at the carpet on the floor or the sort of blank pattern on the wall, and then I can talk without distraction.
Now, empathy. You have a chapter talking about empathy and logic. You say that people with Asperger's lack most feelings of empathy that guide most people in their interactions with others. And yet you also say, and I can attest just by being here in the same room with you, you look like and act like you're quite a gentle person. You do care for people. It's very obvious in the book. You fell in love. You love your child. So what do you mean by lack of empathy?
Well, first of all, I don't say that people with Asperger's lack empathy. I would never say that. What I say is that people like me often lack the expected outward displays of emotion or empathy or affection. Folks like me a lot of the time look like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. We are logical and our faces don't change. We don't smile. We don't frown. That doesn't mean that we are not feeling happy or sad emotions. It just means that you can't observe them as readily.
And is that because you're more directed inward, or why is that, I guess I'd just like to ask?
I believe it's because in an autistic person, often the part of the brain that governs those kinds of social behaviors is just not that well developed. So my ability to read facial expressions is virtually non-existent. My ability to read your body language is very limited. I only display a limited range of facial expression and body language. And sometimes, as I describe in Look Me in the Eye, the expressions that I might display are opposite what an ordinary person might expect in a given situation.
Could you give an example?
In my book, I talk about an example where some friend of my mother's had a friend whose kid was hit by a train and killed. And I heard that news, and I kind of thought about it for a minute, and I smiled at it. And my mother's friend looked at me like I was some kind of little monster. And when I think back about that, my thinking was that first, I'm glad I didn't get hit by a train and killed. I'm glad my parents didn't get hit by a train and got killed. I'm glad my brother didn't get hit by a train. I would never be stupid enough to go play in the train tracks like that kid did, so I wouldn't get killed by a train. And now that all the people around me are definitely alive and none of us got killed by a train, I can smile with relief at that. And explained that way, I think it makes sense.
It not only makes sense, but it actually makes sense even from an empathy point of view, because what you're really describing is that you're putting yourself in the shoes of that kid and seeing how, well, you're relieved you're not having their experience. And isn't that really the basis of empathy?
I think it is, and I think that when I look at people that I see in daily life, and they make this incredibly big fuss over that, or a bus crashed in Nepal and 20 people got killed, and they're crying and wailing over what a terrible thing that is, I guess to me we have to put that in perspective. People die all over the world every minute, and I think that many of those displays are kind of plays for attention, and I separate that from the true empathy one would feel about something that's happening to a husband or wife or a son or daughter or even, you know, your pet or your close friend, something that's part of your pack.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with John Elder Robison about his book, Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's. You mentioned Mr. Spock as a picture of the logical, rational person. And you have a chapter on logic versus small talk, which I thought had a wonderful example in your book. And I'd like to have you read a little portion of it. A friend of yours comes to you and she says, one of my girlfriends having an affair and the guy rides a motorcycle just like yours. And you had an awful lot of trouble decoding what was the expected response from you. Okay, start with Lori's statement posed a problem, and then let's go down to...
For example, last week my friend Lori said, one of my girlfriends is having an affair, and the guy rides a motorcycle just like yours. Lori's statement posed a problem. Unlike most interactions, ours had not started with a question. Should I respond with an opinion about her statement, or should I ask a question myself? I considered what I had just heard. Lori has a girlfriend. Yes, Lori has lots of girlfriends. Which one is she talking about? The girlfriend's having an affair. Why tell me? Do I know her? Do I know the guy? Is this a convoluted way of suggesting that I should have an affair since I have a motorcycle? The boyfriend has a motorcycle. Well, that narrows it down. Most potential boyfriends have cars, not bikes. So this boyfriend is one of the 5% as opposed to the 95% of the motoring public. Do I know him? The motorcycle is just like mine. How much does Lori know about bikes? Does she mean he rides an Electroglide Classic, or does she just mean his motorcycle is black? I was not able to deduce a suitable response to her statements. What did she mean by them? There was no logical connection between Laurie's sentences. I stared at the floor and pondered my next move. I knew I had to think fast, because if I think too long, people say, "Did you hear me?" or "Are you paying attention?" I knew she wanted a relevant response, something connected to what she had just said, more than just, "Oh." I also knew from experience and observation that a statement like, "I went to the Newport Jazz Festival last weekend," would not be an appropriate answer. It occurred to me that what I needed to do was keep gathering information until I could frame an intelligent conversation. The successful conversational computer programs all did that, so I asked a question. "Which girlfriend is that?" Lori looked surprised. "Why would you want to know that?" she said. I hadn't expected a challenge. She sounded suspicious. I wiggled my ears and wondered a little at that. The fact that she had responded that way told me she had been expecting some other response. What did she expect me to say? Perhaps I should have answered with a made-up statement that echoed hers. I could have said, "My friend Spike is having an affair, too, and the girl he's involved with has a motorcycle like mine also." But it would have been nonsense, and I never utter nonsense replies unless I'm playing a prank. I can't help thinking there must have been some purpose to Lori's original statement, and a statement with a purpose calls for a meaningful response. Perhaps I should have just played dumb. I've observed that a drawled "wow" accompanied by a smile can be an acceptable response to almost anything. But I can't smile on command, and I can't bring myself to act idiotic. Still, a "wow" would probably not have disturbed Lori. If I say, "One of the guys at work got into a car accident today," I am prepared for you to respond, "Who was in the wreck?" If the identity of the person were a secret, why would I bring it up in the first place? I could have focused on the motorcycle part of Lori's statement. If so, I'd have said, what kind of bike does he ride? Once again, I'd expect some kind of answer other than, it's none of your business. When I asked Laurie why she was suspicious, she had a couple of questions for me. Why do you need to know? Nothing good could come of me telling you. What if it got back to her husband? I figured out what I should have said by chance, observing two women talking in a restaurant a short while later. Jenny in accounting is having an affair, and the guy drives a Corvette. The opening line was strikingly similar, so I paid attention. How cool is that? Is he married? Listening to that exchange, it was obvious that this was the correct response. When I heard them talk, I suddenly understood that Laurie's statement had been meant to entertain or impress me, and that my response should have been an expression of admiration or excitement. However, that never occurred to me. It's clear to me that regular people have conversational capabilities far beyond mine, and their responses often have nothing at all to do with logic. I suspect normal people are hardwired to develop the ability to read social cues in a way that I am not.
That's just a marvelous story. And, I mean, on the one hand, it's very funny, because right there for one's inspection is, in fact, the kind of bizarre mystery of social interaction, which you are working so hard to decode. And it occurred to me, that's a very painful process in a way, to have to go through so much logic, rational thought, to decode something that, you know, comes so easily and unconsciously really to other people. Was that painful?
No, it isn't a painful process. It's a process where there's an obvious reward. If you can decode what people mean in their sentences, you're going to get along better. The idea that it's painful is not right. Sometimes it's painful when you fail to engage people and you're lonely. Absolutely, that's painful, being lonely. But any process by which you ameliorate that is certainly not painful.
I guess part of my question comes out of, well, there was loneliness. There was a lot of painful loneliness when you were younger and you hadn't yet figured out this process.
That's certainly true. I've been lonely progressively less as I've gotten older. Once I learned about Asperger's and I learned some of these sort of secrets of getting along, it truly brought about a remarkable transformation. People invite me to lunch, and they invite me out places, and they want me to do things with them. All of a sudden, I'm like surrounded by friends when, as a kid, I didn't have any.
We're talking today about Asperger's syndrome. My guest is John Elder Robison, and his book is Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's. Talking about when you were a kid, in your book, you talk about the home you grew up in, which was a pretty dysfunctional home. It was famously written about by your brother, Augustine Burroughs, in Running with Scissors. You were the brunt of a lot of your dad's violence.
Well, that's true. I was 8 years older than my brother, and my father, I guess, was meaner in the early years. He'd kind of moderated by the time my brother got bigger.
Do you feel like there was any interaction that kind of what was going on in your home was part or exacerbated at least the Asperger's that you were born with?
I actually think the Asperger's sort of protected me from crazy stuff in my childhood, because my inability to sense social cues and undertones and conversations and stuff meant that all I really dealt with was the literal meaning of the words spoken to me. And I think that I probably missed a lot of nasty innuendo and stuff as a kid as a result of that.
Hmm. Now, at one point, your mother took you to a shrink who became rather strange, or maybe even started out as rather strange, had a kind of cult-like following, but he also stopped the violence. Tell us something about him.
I think the doctor was a well-known figure in the community back in the 1970s and 80s. And when I first met him, it was probably around 1970. And indeed, for some reason, even though my mother had gone with me and my father to all these other therapists all my life, somehow the doctor was able to tell my father that he couldn't just beat me up when he got mad, and that took. My father never did it again. I don't know that I can really tell you what the magic was that he had that caused that to happen, but it certainly did.
Now, you also had some really great gifts and have some really great gifts as a child, though, in particular, or maybe not as a young child, but I'm talking here as a teenager. You left school, you didn't get your GED, you dropped out of high school, and you began working with creating soundboards, sound effects circuit boards for rock bands in an almost savant-like manner. And I wonder if you could just read on page 64, there's one paragraph there that describes it, and I guess I'd like to hear a little bit more even about it. It was just fascinating.
I began experimenting with transistorized circuit designs. The old Fender guitar amps were tube technology designs from the 1950s. Transistor amplifiers were newer, and integrated circuits were the state of the art when I started in music. By studying the circuits, I figured out how to make little battery-powered special effects boxes. I worked hard to imagine the results of my designs, and I refined my thought process as I would visualize a circuit, then build it for real, and then compare my imagined results with the real results. Gradually, I became able to visualize the results of my designs with a fair degree of accuracy. My earlier problem, an inability to read mathematics textbooks, stopped holding me back as I developed the ability to visualize and even imagine or hear in my mind the flow of sound through my circuits. At that point, I had made several key breakthroughs. First, I had gained an understanding of the electronic components themselves. They were the building blocks of everything else to follow. Next, I somehow figured out how to visualize the complex calculus functions that describe the behavior of electronic circuits in time. For example, I saw the pure tones of a guitar going into a circuit, and I saw the modified waves, which were immeasurably more complex, coming out, and I heard in my mind what those modified waves would sound like. I understood how changes in the circuit topology or component values would alter the waves and how that would sound. And most remarkably, I developed the ability to translate those waves into sounds, and the sounds that I imagined actually matched what emerged from loudspeakers when I built the circuits and tested them. No one knows why one person has a gift like this and another doesn't, but I've met other Aspergian people with similar savant-like abilities. In my opinion, part of this ability, which I seem to have been born with, comes from my extraordinary power of concentration. I have an extremely sharp focus.
That's an extraordinary description. Are you saying that you actually could hear the music as you looked at, transistors, are they soldered, is that right, on a circuit board?
Yeah, they're soldered into a circuit board.
So it would be the pattern with which you actually lay down the solder that...
No, it would be the diagram of the circuit. The circuit diagram is not the same. I would take the circuit diagram that showed schematically how electrons flowed through the different paths, and I would imagine the results of those designs.
Wow. And yet, this is not something that, you've looked at those designs and you've said, I don't know how I did that. It's not something you have today. Why is that?
Now that I'm older, my brain, I believe, has rewired itself. I have tremendously greater social skills. I have a much more diverse range of knowledge. Some other reasoning powers in my brain are significantly better developed than when I was 16 or 17 years old. And the trade-off is that I have lost that extremely focused brilliance that allowed me to imagine those circuits, while at the same time I could do little else in other areas.
What strikes me, first of all, is the incredible plasticity of the brain. You know, a lot of people think that the brains are only plastic when people are children, but you're really saying that this, your brain has changed as you've gotten older.
Well, it's very important to note that I don't say it. You can observe it. If you read my book, one theme that comes through is you'll see how I had these abilities in electronics, and I pursued a career creating electronic devices. Then I chose a somewhat different path and worked on creating electronic games. Still electronic, but different. Then I went into a completely different direction and did creative work in restoring cars, plus pursued the creative aspects of organizing and building a business. Then I took up photography, yet another creative pursuit, and made a success of that. And finally, at age 50, I took up book writing, and the fact that I was able to do these things at essentially 10-year intervals throughout my life, I think is very strong evidence that the brain continues to evolve and change right through our lives.
And all in a more and more social and emotional direction.
Yes, that's exactly right. One could argue that looking at each of these careers that I have followed, each one was a progressively more successful attempt on the part of my subconscious to gain acceptance from the wider world and to become part of the human pack. Just as if I was a dog, I would want to be part of my pack, or as if I was a chimp, I'd want to be part of the pack.
We're talking for most of this hour with John Elder Robison about his book, Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking today about Asperger's syndrome with John Elder Robison. Just before the break, Robison was talking about the unusual savant-like abilities that he had when he was much younger and that diminished somewhat as he became older. However, his creativity has remained undiminished. I asked him whether he thought that there might be a relationship between his creativity and his Asperger's.
I think that creativity, essentially, is the ability to think of things that are different, right, that haven't been done before. And if you think about where that comes from, and you look at my own childhood and my brain as an example, I was not able to endure the regimentation of class. I couldn't sit in class and listen to the teacher teach me about calculus. I couldn't see the practical application of it. I couldn't do it. And yet, I had to understand the essentials of calculus to understand how waveforms, wave patterns would be altered as they move through these electronic circuits. So now, faced with a practical need to know, I was able to imagine the solutions. And since I had not participated in the calculus class, and in fact I had failed those classes, I had to figure it out my own way because there was no teacher to help me. And when people figure things out their own way, that's what leads to the breakthroughs that drive society forward. So I would contend that many of the breakthroughs that change our world and make it what it is today come from people who are misfits, who can't learn things in the conventional way, and they have to learn it in some out-of-the-box way, and those are the results. They think of new stuff.
Asperger's is classified as a disorder, and yet what you're talking about doesn't sound like a disorder to me.
Well, I think calling it a disorder is, you know, kind of obnoxious. It's kind of a belittling sort of term. I would recognize that I am eccentric and unusual, and people could say that I am abnormal for what I am. But, you know, I would also say that you can look at many people who are hailed as brilliant inventors and innovators, and you find a one of those people that's not described as eccentric or weird or bizarre. I think that's a characteristic that goes hand in hand with intelligence and creativity.
You mentioned your pranks before. I found there were a lot of them that were just incredibly funny in the book. One of them you did when you were a teenager. You were invited to a faculty party near here in Amherst, Massachusetts, where we're talking with John Elder Robison about his book, Look Me in the Eye. So you were at a faculty party where you pretended to be a garbage man from Springfield, which is a nearby city. I'd like you to read from kind of the bottom of 98 to the top of 99, but first, set the scene for us.
Well, first of all, my family was at the University of Massachusetts. My father was the head of the philosophy department, and my mother was involved in the community in English and writing. And this particular party was at Amherst College, which is an altogether more upscale and snootier kind of establishment in some ways. And my parents had brought me to the 40th birthday party of one of their friends. Now, I was 16 years old, and I had just dropped out of high school, and I was surrounded by all of these people with a very high self-image and cigars and pipes and stuff, and they were all talking about their kids and the wonderful things they were doing. "We have a son about your age," one person told me. "We're very proud of him. He's starting at Harvard in the fall." Just then, another couple walked over, and the woman said, "Our daughter Janet has decided to go to Smith. She'll be there for 4 more years, and what are you doing?" And all of them looked at me. I wasn't doing anything in particular. I certainly wasn't going to Harvard. Somehow, I was in the improbable position of scoring in the 99th percentile on intelligence tests and still flunking out of high school. I was sure that this crowd would just sneer at the idea of my growing reputation with local bands, so I decided not to mention it. "I've actually started on a career," I said. "Really? What are you doing?" This came from Thurston, another pompous friend of Annette's. Thurston, a department head at Amherst College, was far removed from making any career choices himself. He stood there, drink in hand, with a superior smile. Perhaps he was thinking of visiting Thugwald, or whatever his son's name was, at Yale. "I've gotten into the waste management business down in Springfield. They've started me right on the bottom so I can really learn the business, on a truck in the North End." "You mean you're a garbage collector?" someone asked, polite but incredulous. Garbage collectors were not usually seen at Amherst College faculty parties. Garbage collectors came in afterward and emptied the trash. They did not participate in creating the trash with their intellectual betters. I smiled back. "We don't call ourselves garbage collectors. We are sanitary engineers." By this time, another older fellow had stepped over to join the conversation. I didn't know him, but with his curly hair, tweed coat, and bow tie, he probably was not a sanitary engineer. "I'm an engineer," he said. "I went to college for 8 years for the privilege, and I don't think a mere city garbage collector has the right to call himself an engineer." I decided to change the subject. "You know, we see all kinds of things at work. Just last week, one of my buddies found a dead baby in the dumpster behind one of the dorms at the college in Springfield." That was met with shocked silence. "We heard the mother was a student here. No one knows why she threw the baby away. Her father was the president of some big company, but she's in jail now." There were 6 people gathered around, and I had given them something to think about. Would their own daughter do something like that? One of the moms forced a smile and said, "It must be hard being out there in all kinds of weather." The weather isn't the problem. We can take weather. It's the packs of wild dogs and feral children you really have to worry about. Feral children? That surprised them. We meet them in the rougher parts of town. Two of them hit one of our guys in the head with a beer bottle full of gravel, and it cut him up bad, almost killed him. They're worst when they're in packs, and some of them carry knives. My audience looked shocked. "Can you get a police escort?" one asked. "No, the police don't care. They have their own problems. It's a city, you know. We started carrying billy clubs. They won't let us carry guns. A few of the guys carry motorcycle chains. We wear them like necklaces. A punk with a knife is no match for one of us with a motorcycle chain." I let them digest that for a moment. They would see their local trash man in a whole new light now. They looked horrified, but they couldn't help themselves. I was not your usual faculty party entertainment.
That's wonderful. Well, thanks, John Robison, for reading some of the stories from your wonderful book, Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's, and thanks for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having me on. And we should also tell the listeners that anyone with a personal connection to Asperger's or autism can go to my website, johnrobison.com, and I've got a resources page with lots and lots of Asperger and autism resources nationwide. I've got a blog, which is jerobison.blogspot.com. And there's a huge community on the blog of Aspergian people and parents and families and mental health professionals. And anyone who wants to know more will find a good welcome there.
That's great. And we'll be sure to link to your websites on our website, writersvoice.net. You can also go there to hear Robison talking about how he told his son the real story of Santa Claus. Did you know that Santa Claus was a longshoreman on the lam? You can hear all about it at writersvoice.net. We turn now to an issue that's been on simmer for a while, but just in the past week has come again to a boil. On Monday in Boston, the FCC held a hearing about network neutrality. That's the idea that users should be able to access all internet content equally easily, without internet providers being able to slow or block access to sites they prefer to steer customers away from. For example, rival sites providing movie content, or sites disagreeing with the company's political views. Monday's FCC hearing was held to look into allegations that one of the big players in the debate over network neutrality, service provider Comcast, was blocking internet traffic. But Comcast also was doing some physical jamming of rival viewpoints at the hearing. They hired people off the street to pack seats at the meeting and effectively kept many opponents out of the room. To help us make sense of the issue, we turn to my next guest, Josh Silver. He's head of the national advocacy organization Free Press, which has offices in Washington, D.C. and Northampton, Massachusetts. Josh Silver, welcome to Writer's Voice again.
Thank you.
We've had you on before talking about the all-important issue of net neutrality, network neutrality, and of preserving our free speech. It's been much in the news this week because there was a big to-do over in Boston at an FCC hearing. I've already told our listeners a little bit about that, and also about the Comcast seat warmers that were paid to fill the room. But tell us what exactly was going on in Boston, and what did Comcast do?
Francesca, there is a huge debate that's happening. It's underway over the future of the internet, and it is, as you say, it is all important because, you know, this really is a fight not just about sort of gigabytes and terabytes. This is about the future of virtually all communications in this country. Television, radio, phone service, it's all moving to the internet. So what happens here in the world of policymaking over the next couple of years will really determine whether or not every website could be like a TV network or a radio network. It's a profound importance. What happened on Monday at Harvard University in Cambridge in Massachusetts was that there was a hearing held by the Federal Communications Commission chairman with all five FCC commissioners present to haul Comcast Corporation up in front of them under proven allegations that Comcast had indeed been blocking content going over their pipes, content that went to Comcast subscribers that they slowed down or even blocked an application called BitTorrent. The reason this is of particular concern, BitTorrent is a program that allows users to send large files over the Internet, like video, radio programs, large files that are in direct competition with Comcast's video service that they are increasingly moving to a digital platform as well. So what's interesting is Comcast knew things were going to get ugly, and they ended up, to our amazement, hiring dozens of people off the street, giving them what we've heard to be $100 each, to actually go into the hearing and sit there and take up the chairs that would have otherwise been held by genuinely concerned citizens who wanted to know more about this issue and who are not happy about what Comcast has done.
And they showed up an hour and a half early, right?
They showed up at 7:30 in the morning, and a quote from the Harvard staffer said, "I think it's disingenuous to say that they were holding spots for Comcast employees, because the Comcast VIPs were saying, oh, no, these people were only there to hold their spot in our spot in line. They didn't stay through this hearing," when in fact it was proven that that none of these so-called Comcast employees ever came, and these hired guns just sat there and blocked what ended up being over 100 people who were genuinely there to take part, blocked them from getting into the hearing.
Now, this hearing was about BitTorrent. This is something that a whole lot of people use, but it's not just Comcast that's doing things like this. This is bigger than just this one issue.
Well, it's bigger than this one issue on several levels. I mean, Comcast is the one who's been most brazen about it, but there is really just a much larger issue at stake here. The whole issue of net neutrality is really, again, it's about whether or not companies like Comcast or Verizon, which control 96% of broadband high-speed connections in the Bay State, whether or not they are allowed to slow down or block content over the Internet based on who's sending it. So what they're saying is, trust us. We don't need laws that prevent us from blocking content, because we're good players. We're not going to do anything bad. Then they were found out. They were discovered by investigative reporters and some techno geeks to be blocking this BitTorrent service. So the irony here is they're not only blocking content on the web, they're blocking ordinary citizens from coming to a hearing like the federal communications hearing on Monday to really get involved in the issue. We can't trust these folks. There can't be this kind of gatekeeping on the Internet, and people should be outraged.
I think a lot of people don't, they don't think about maybe the issue of net neutrality as being a democracy issue, but when they see Comcast coming in, and they've admitted to this as well, is that right? Then it becomes a much clearer, the whole issue of democracy and access to expression.
Sure, and even more important, sometimes we forget, we are in a participatory democracy, and democracy requires an informed citizenry, and people increasingly realize, as we sort of come out of the fog of the past 7 years particularly, that the real greatest problem in this country is the fact that well over 70% of the American population get their news from commercial television news, not from public radio, not from Pacifica or NPR. And they're not getting hard-hitting critical journalism. And so when we look at the issue of creating diversity of media content, of creating and cultivating investigative journalism by opening up access and distribution to crucial information like these issues are about, we're seeing that this is really about whether or not the lifeblood of democracy will course through the veins of the United States, or whether it will be stopped by companies like Comcast and Verizon.
You talk about, or Free Press, actually, which, by the way, our listeners can go to freepress.net, where all of this is talked about, as well as savetheinternet.net. And we will link to those websites from our website at writersvoice.net. On that website, it's talked about an issue as between a closed and open internet. Say something about that. What do you mean by closed? This issue of power, you've already said something about control over BitTorrent, trying to stop that. But what are some of the other ways in which internet access is being controlled or tamped down by these companies, or could be?
Well, it's actually quite simple. And what it means is, if you think back 10 years ago, many people were just starting to get dial-up internet connections. And if you recall, you had choices. There was Earthlink, there was Net Zero, there was in Massachusetts here, there was something called JavaNet. There were many different providers. It pushed the cost of monthly access to dial-up internet, which is painfully slow, to sometimes as low as $5 or $10 a month. There was competition that was created by a federal law that told companies like Verizon or AT&T that they had to share the lines going into people's homes with these internet competitors. What's happened since then is that federal government policies have closed the internet so that there's no longer laws that tell Verizon or AT&T or Comcast that they have to share the wires going into homes to other competitors. That's why 96% of Americans have one or two choices, DSL or cable, and no others, and that's why we have a closed system that cuts off any real competition. If we had open access laws that forced competition and allowed other entrepreneurs and internet service providers to compete, we wouldn't have most of these problems.
You know, I just went through this very issue myself because I got tired of Verizon's high phone fees and decided to go to voice over internet service. I went with Vonage, and I think at some point I'm going to migrate to the even cheaper Skype. But as a result, I get DSL service from Verizon. They gave me what is called a dry line, which means that they basically are giving me less service, but they're charging me $10 more a month for this. And when I went looking around for maybe some other way of getting DSL or internet access, the only other option is Comcast, and that's just as expensive, if not more so, right there. So I'm stuck.
You're stuck, and there's not going to be any improvement unless the government steps in and does what they've done since 1934, when policies started regulating things like radio and television that really mandate competition. You have to realize, in the last 5 years, the United States has slipped from number 5 to number 16 globally in broadband penetration. You can go to a place like Japan or France or South Korea, and you can get internet speeds that are 10, 20, 30 times faster than here and for a third of the price. And that's because there is competition, and when things don't work well with Verizon, you've got 10 other service providers you can choose from. And the only reason that this has continued to go this way is because of the immense power that these companies have in Washington, with millions of dollars in campaign contributions, armies of lobbyists, and really one of the most corrupt policymaking systems in the developed world. And that's our job. Our job is to go to sites like freepress.net, savetheinternet.com, sign petitions to support legislation. Right now, there's legislation in the U.S. House of Representatives called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act that would fix this problem. And it really is time for people across the country to get involved with media issues and understand that they are critical to every issue that everyone cares about.
Now, say that again. What is that legislation that's up? And tell us just very briefly in the less than a minute that we have left what it is, and then give those websites again, because I think I gave the wrong website before.
It's called the Internet Freedom Preservation Act. It was introduced by Representatives Markey and Pickering in the U.S. House of Representatives recently. It would reinforce network neutrality laws and promote open access. It would force the FCC to ensure competition, and it would really go a long way towards fixing this problem. I think one thing that is encouraging, there are several candidates, the major Democratic candidates have come out in support of net neutrality and against media concentration. I think there is a growing movement that's coming together at SaveTheInternet.com and FreePress.net, and it's important that people go there and learn more.
Josh Silver of FreePress.net, of Free Press, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. And again, we'll be sure to link to those websites, and we really urge everybody to get involved.
Thank you, Francesca.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we talk with historian Eric Weitz about Weimar Germany, promise and tragedy, and some parallels to our own time. If you missed any portion of today's show, go to our website, writersvoice.net. You can stream or download past shows and subscribe to our podcast. Send your comments and suggestions to writersvoice@wmua.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.